then, as I said, gladly accepted the terms of emancipation, the terms of emancipation that were laid down by the state, and of which the work of Doom, which I talked about last time, was such a good example. One of the results was a change in the whole attitude towards the community itself. All over the West, and even into Poland, the rich leaders of the community furthered a new kind of rabbi who, as a treatise of 1823 tells us, preached the love of country and the willing response to military service as the chief duty. Indeed, one leader of German Jewry wrote as follows in a Jewish paper in 1815. There is only one form of baptism which makes for national unity, and that is the baptism of blood in the common battle for liberty and the fatherland. Obviously, the duty of military service was seen by many Jews, as well as by Gentiles, as the final pinnacle of integration. Now, this idea of patriotism, which involves this preaching love of country, this military service, must not be confused with a support for reaction. For example, another famous leader of German Jewry, whose name you don't have to remember, Gabriel Rieser, in an equally famous article, saw the progress of Jewish emancipation intertwined with the German fight for freedom and for unity. In fact, Rieser is an interesting case study. His ambition was to be the first Jewish parliamentary representative in a German state. He believed, as did many, that active citizenship was as important as military service, as the road to emancipation. And active citizenship meant active involvement in politics. To be sure, Rieser suffered many humiliations. He did not make it, but finally he took a leading role in 1848 in the famous all-German Frankfurt Assembly. Rieser was not alone. The Frankfurt Assembly of 1848 is also a milestone in Jewish emancipation. For in that famous all-German assembly during the revolution of 1848, seven Jews sat in that parliament, all liberals, some more radical than others, but all liberals. For such men, wealthy lawyers, for the most part, crashing politics was then a way of integration. Another famous example is Heinrich Marx, Karl Marx's father. To his baptism, I shall come back later. Heinrich Marx, Karl Marx's father, who involved himself as a lawyer in the movement for liberal parliamentary reform in the Rhineland. But he took the consequence of baptism, as you will see, with the others that did not. These men then were liberals, and you must not confound patriotism and reaction. In their eyes, their involvement with politics and with military service was both patriotism, re-education, and a fight for freedom, a continuation of the Enlightenment and of the French Revolution. Let me quote two leading people who were in that tradition. Johann Jacobi, another Jew who sat in the Frankfurt Parliament, who said in 1832, "We shall sacrifice all our other interests and work towards a constitution, freedom of the press, and an assembly truly representative of the people. These general benefits will surely bring our emancipation in their way, by which he meant Jewish emancipation. Just as I am a Jew and a German at the same time, so the Jew in me cannot be free without the German, and the German not without the Jew. Our Messiah is progressive time, which ever more vigorously shakes the bond of old prejudice. In these quotations, you have an obvious continuation of the Enlightenment. You have an obvious idea that freedom is now indivisible, German freedom and Jewish freedom. On the part of these wealthy lawyers who crashed German politics and who were the first to crash politics anywhere as far as Jews were concerned. Or finally, a quote from Berner, the famous liberal writer, "Because I was born a bondsman, I therefore love liberty more than you. Yes, because I have known slavery, I understand freedom more than you. Yes, because I was born without a fatherland, my desire for a fatherland is more passionate than you." These quotations go to the very essence of the process of assimilation as it was developing. Especially this quote from Berner, that because I have known slavery, I understand freedom more than you. Because I was born without a fatherland, my desire for a fatherland is more passionate than yours. These active, rather wealthy Jews, lawyers for the most part, were not, however, typical for all of Jewish society. By and large, Jewish bankers and commerce especially attempted political neutrality, and Jewish orthodoxy, a minority movement, as you will see, was hostile to 1848, was hostile to liberalism, and linked itself to the reaction. Yet, without the attitude of such people, emancipation would not have advanced, and indeed, they are the most important agent of its advancement. What about then the attitude of such people, leaders in their community, as they were leaders in their community, to Judaism and themselves as Jews? For we must remember, and it is, I think, of essence for us to remember, that there is as yet no real separation between Judaism and Jew. If you were a Jew, you still had to come to terms with Judaism. This is not the future. Eventually, this will be no longer necessary, obviously. But now it is necessary. Judaism and Jew were still part of a common identification, had not yet split asunder. But with men like Risa, like Jacobi, I quoted to you, Mendelssohn's balance was imperiled, not just because of the slender nature of this balance, we've said enough of that so you can understand it, but because the cultural climate of Europe was changing. The cultural climate of Europe was changing. To put it in shorthand, by 1800, the Enlightenment had given way to Romanticism. The change in the cultural climate of Europe meant, in fact, a revival of Christianity after the Enlightenment. You must remember that in Romanticism, Christianity and a romantic attitude went together, both as a reaction to the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. A new kind of Christian revival, a new kind of romantic attitude, now became the hallmark of civilized people. When Moses Mendelssohn had talked about civilized people and the Jews joining civilized people, he had meant the Enlightenment. When people after 1800 talked about Jews joining the civilized people, they meant Romanticism, and they had to mean Christianity as well. For Christian revival goes hand in hand with romanticism. To be sure, if the Christian revival would have happened earlier, there would have been no emancipation. For neither romanticism nor the Christian revival believed in progress, believed in the possibility of re-education. And therefore, if romanticism and the Christian revival had come earlier, I think there is no question that there would have been no Jewish emancipation. For instead, romanticism believed, as some of you know, in the pathology of souls, especially in intellectual circles. The whole of emancipation was therefore regarded as ambivalent at best. Typical for that is Friedrich Schleiermacher, who stands at the center of romanticism. Friedrich Schleiermacher, who married the eldest daughter of Moses Mendelssohn, Dorothea Mendelssohn, who married her eventually. Schleiermacher revived Christianity as a non-theological, romantic religion, but he revived it nevertheless. He was a clergyman, not in the 18th century fashion, but in the fashion of a revived Christianity. That is what is important to remember. That is what he was. And therefore, when he came to look at Jews, he said the following. There is a peculiar danger in the Enlightenment. It might lead to a common Jewish-Christian religion of reason that is not unperceptive, as we have already seen. There were great elements, even in Moses Mendelssohn, which would lead to a common Christian-Jewish religion of reason. But in this case, says Schleiermacher, the idea of Christian salvation would be undermined from within. Not only would the idea of Christian salvation be undermined, but as he put it finally, Christianity would relapse into Judaism. In other words, the Enlightenment is now condemned as what it was, in fact, anti-Christian. Christianity would relapse into Judaism now. Because Christianity revived in this manner, it was, of course, now said not only to surpass Judaism, but the condemnation of Judaism, of the Enlightenment, was deepened. Judaism, after all, was now taken to be the opposite of romanticism, of the true pathology of souls, of the true emotion, of the truth of inner emotional man, a truth which now corresponded not to reason, but to Christianity, an emotional truth, in other words. For Judaism was, after all, a legalistic religion. And not only that, a religion with a vengeful God. Moses Mendelssohn in Jerusalem, as I told you before, had spent a lot of time disproving that the God of the Jews is a vengeful God. And there seemed in Judaism no room for emotions with all the 360 ceremonial laws. And therefore, no true, well, whatever the hell it is. And therefore, the true religion of the Spirit could not flourish. Before you laugh at me, ask yourselves whether you're keeping them all. For Hegel, for example, Christianity, after all, for Hegel, was the mediating synthesis, the true spirituality. Truly enough, Schleiermacher and Hegel stressed the Gospel of St. John. I feel greatly tempted to ask you why he would stress the Gospel of St. John, why that is important to see how cultured you actually are, but I shall restrain myself. The Gospel of St. John is that Gospel which, you, as you may remember, that where Judaism is treated as a foreign religion. In fact, the Gospel of St. John is known in general as the anti-Semitic Gospel, which in fact it is. It is the Gospel where Judaism is treated as a foreign religion. Judaism tended, therefore, to be viewed by Hegel, by Schleiermacher, as a fossil, as atavistic. And to go one step further, the unemotional Christianity, the established Christian churches, were viewed as a product of Judaism. Now, this becomes important later in the history of anti-Semitism, but I must mention it here. For they blamed all laws and regulation and establishment in Christianity on St. Paul. Rightly, by the way. Christianity doesn't exist. It should be called Paul. He made it. On St. Paul. But St. Paul, as you know, was a Jew who changed his name. You know all this. Therefore, their condemnation of established Christianity was connected with their view of the Jews. It is St. Paul the Jew who had perverted Christianity into a legalism. Now what has happened here is fairly simply said. The group condemnation of Judaism by the Enlightenment is carried through to Romanticism. Because the Enlightenment had taken a similar view of Judaism as a deep superstition. We went over that and you remember it. It is carried on in Romanticism and deepened, but the weapon is now not deism and rationalism. The Enlightenment thought Judaism and Jews as a group were an obstacle to a rational world. Now the condemnation is put back to Christianity. That is to say, Judaism is opposed to Christianity, it is a fossil, and what is bad in Christianity is indeed the fall of Jews. It is very important that Kant, the great philosopher, shared this attitude. For in a sense, Kant stands at the beginning of the 19th century like a giant. Anything that he would say about it is of the greatest importance for the future. For Kant explicitly held that Judaism and the categorical imperative are mutually exclusive. The categorical imperative is a moral idea. Judaism is a legalistic fossil. They are mutually exclusive. As Kant said it, the Jewish faith typifies mere statutory law upon which a state was founded. Jewry is no religion, but a community living under political laws. It is, in fact, and I always come back to that, a state within a state. Therefore, Judaism has no spiritual or moral quality. What Romanticism said is the chief accusation against Jews and Judaism of the entire 19th century. As somebody said eventually, the Jewish question is a question of ethics. Jews who believe in Judaism can have no ethics in their statutory and political religion. Ethics are the categorical imperative. Ethics is the romantic Christianity. I wish you would remember for the future this concept, which now begins, that the Jewish question is a question of ethics. This needed more response from Jews than just calling oneself Israelites or Mosaic instead of Jews. And so, in a combination of emancipation and meeting the romantic accusation, we start the changes in the Jewish community under a double threat, emancipation and accusation of the romantics. As I have outlined it, you get the beginning of the reform. Now, what had been the outward accusation? Judaism is a fossil. It cannot have emotion. True emotion is impossible. It's an ethical question. And then they said, look at the Jewish service. The word for Jewish service is very important in our context. It is called the Judenschule, the Jew school. I will now give you a definition of Jewish religious service from a dictionary, Compass Dictionary of 1808. Jewish service, a Jew school, where disorder, gesticulation, and chaos reign. What it meant, and don't underestimate semantics, what it meant is that the word Judenschule became a part of the European, and especially Central European, vocabulary, and is it to this day. It became another word for chaos and disorder and ugliness and gesticulation. Still today, this is a general word. If there is a chaos, it is a Judenschule. This is a general word, and as such you will find it in dictionaries to this very day. This was, of course, implied a religious service which had no dignity, which had no spirituality, and which linked with the general condemnation of Judaism as a legalistic, mundane kind of a religion. That must be clear. What was the response? The response is, in a famous order for religious service of 1810 by the Jewish Consistory of Westphalia, order and solemnity must be introduced into the Jewish service in imitation to Protestantism. And as a result, parts of the Jewish service in which the congregation participated, I don't know how many of you have been to an Orthodox Jewish service, but in an Orthodox Jewish service, there are no priests, everybody participates. These parts were now given over to the cantor. That is where the modern idea of the cantor occurs. This in strict imitation of Protestantism. The noisiest and most undignified festival of the Jewish calendar, the reading of the scroll of Esther on Purim, that reading of the scroll of Esther, which is the occasion of a great deal of merrymaking, was abolished. That was abolished and banned. Yet, in that service, German was not yet required. Such reforms spread like wildfire. They were, therefore, at once a means of emancipation, like patriotism, and a reply to accusation. It meant, very soon, the omission of the adoration. That is to say, the adoration in the Jewish service, with its exclusivist tendency to see God as the God of Israel. Just so, it was no longer in the new service the Messiah who would lead Israel back to Palestine, but God who will redeem Israel and all mankind. The emphasis was now on all mankind. The universalism was stressed. This reform is the beginning of what we call the Jewish Reform Movement. The impetus to that reform were given by what we might call the haute bourgeoisie, that is, the wealthy lawyers and bankers, about whom I have talked before, who wanted to crash politics. The wealthy bankers and merchants, the leaders in all West European communities who gave the impetus. Inspired by the rationalistic half of Mendelssohn's ideas, but also inspired now, without doubt, by the Protestant example. The rabbi now undergoes a further transformation. Not only is he to preach patriotism and love of country, but he becomes in effect a minister. And the essence of his preaching concerns Jewish ethics. Why? As a reply to accusations, but also as a carrying on the process of assimilation and emancipation. The stress is now on Jewish ethics. Theologically, this means the stress is on the prophets. The stress is on the prophets and on Jewish ethics. What did the rabbi become? He became a social worker or a scholar of the science of Judaism. The science of Judaism, I shall come back in quite a big way a little later. The emphasis on ethics, therefore, was central. And here, not only rationalism, but also the anti-Semitic accusation. Indeed, more and more, we find the replies to anti-Semitism grounded on ethics. For example, in 1880, in the big wave of anti-Semitism, which we shall, of course, deal with eventually, in the 1880s, what was the Jewish reply? The reply of the Vienna Jewish community was to get out a book on Jewish ethics. This becomes the standard reply on Jewish ethics. Now, what about the Reform movement? It had two wings, a radical and a more conservative. The more conservative, called the neoconservative wing, was to be the dominant Judaism of the West, of all of the West. Its founder was Samson Raphael Hirsch. What can we say about the neo-orthodoxy, as it is called, really Jewish reform, moderate reform, of Samson Raphael Hirsch, its founder? It centered on the Torah. That is to say, it centered on the Bible. It corresponds to Protestant biblicism. It centered on the Bible. Here again, a kind of correspondence to Protestant biblicism. The law, the ceremonial law, the famous one, is modified, and its ethical contents are stressed. But what about Israel? All reform rejected, of course, a national interpretation. That would be counter to this whole thrust in every way. For Hirsch, Israel had a mission. Here we begin the famous mission of Judaism, mission of Jews, to live a Jewish life among the people. Why? To demonstrate the ethical monotheism in which he believes. Now, what has happened? What has happened? In the 18th century, as I told you before, in fact, in Moses Mendelssohn, if you can remember back that far, I hope you can, in Moses Mendelssohn, the Jews were defended not as the chosen people of God, but as the custodians of a rational view of the world. Because they are chosen people, they are chosen by a rational and universal God as chosen people. Therefore, Jews are the custodians of rationalism in the world. What is added here is that this rationalism is ethical monotheism. And Judaism must be preserved. The mission of the Jews is to spread an ethical by which they meant moral and rational monotheism. This stress on the mission of Jews will remain. The reverse side is, of course, that Christianity is not monotheism, as it isn't. There's Christ, there's the Trinity, there is all that. The mission of Judaism, in a way, continues, but it, as Moses Mendelssohn has put it, but it becomes now a part of an ethical monotheism. As such, it will remain into the 20th century. And the greatest Jewish philosopher of the 20th century, Hermann Cohen, will again restate this. He will again restate that in the 1920s. That the mission of the Jews is in fact ethical monotheism. But that mission is also a reply to accusations against Judaism, which I hope I made plain. Nationhood, what do you do? It is, after all, in the Bible, you know. Children of Israel walk around and they have a nation. Nationhood is a transitory state in Israel's history. A merely transitory state. Nothing to do as a transitory state with the mission of Israel. Hirsch advocated assimilation to the state, patriotism. We must further the aims of the state and not consider our own well-being separated from that of the state. This is not contrary to Judaism, for Judaism has always looked at its own nationhood in a spiritual and religious way. Land and soil were never part of Israel's unity. Never. A transitory stage of history, that is all. But if Israel talks about nationhood, it is a purely spiritual conception. A spiritual conception which is part of the mission of Judaism. Far from blood and soil, Judaism is connected to an ethical imperative. Jews must remain Jews, because it is their mission to spread the ethical imperative, the ethical monotheism throughout the world. This is opposed to blood and soil. When Hirsch says that we must support the state, he means, and this should be clear to you now, the liberal state, a state which was conceived by him as it was conceived by the quotation that I have given you earlier. Indeed, it is the mission of the Jews to make the state into an ethical state. And it is the special mission of the Jews, because of their ethical monotheism, to make the state into an ethical state. This idea of vast importance was revived by Hermann Cohen in the 1920s. That this is the special mission of the Jews. It has nothing to do with the soil or whatsoever. These ideas are in Hirsch's so-called 19 letters of 1836. But I point out to you, if this is Judaism, then Judaism is in fact just another religion in the state. Then Judaism is in fact another confession of the state, like Protestantism or Catholicism or any other, for that matter. Neo-Orthodoxy was triumphant. Orthodoxy itself, the old Orthodoxy, was a minority, kept alive only by immigration from Poland and from the masses of East European Jewry. But even in the end, Orthodoxy, the old Orthodoxy, joined. In 1870 in Germany, for example, one Orthodox paper boasts that Orthodoxy was capable of giving a German answer to the problems of the world, just as a Reform was capable of doing it. Now Hirsch is one side of Reform. The other is connected with Abraham Geiger, which is the more radical side of Reform. The other side, which went still further. He stressed the dynamic of tradition, the need to break with the age of darkness, as he called it. And where did the age of darkness last? From the Bible to Moses Mendelssohn. That was the age of darkness, which had to be repudiated, which had to be repudiated. But even in the Bible, much was excluded, and the ceremonial law is now definitely dropped. Moses Mendelssohn's balance in Abraham Geiger is definitely destroyed. The ceremonial law is definitely dropped, and the emphasis here is squarely on the ethics of the prophets. Jewish ethical monotheism, which means the ethics of the prophets. 1854 is the basis of all reform. And if any of you are reformed, that's what you're using today, basically. That book omits all references to Zion, all references to a personal Messiah, and all references to sacrifice. It is very typical that Geiger was one of the seven Jews who sat in the Frankfurt Assembly. He was one of those who crashed politics, who sat in the Frankfurt Assembly and even in the assembly of his state, even there. Geiger held that love for Germany, despite all discrimination, was a nerve which must never be severed. Now, as we look at this reform, we see in it a reaction to assimilation, which transformed the concept of Judaism and therefore the concept of Jew and the concept of community as it had existed up to that time. The reorganization of the service was crucial at a time when there was not yet a separation between Jew and Judaism. But we cannot leave it here. This attitude made one other very important contribution, the change from the past, which Katz mentions on page 40, that change from the past with which Katz ends on page 40, could not be greater. The need for separation, for aloofness, was changed in a way, if you like, into its very opposite. For the most important consequence was this: the service was centered on ethics, on the prophets. It was, in form, a Protestant service, in very many ways. The dignity, the canter, the end to the Jewish school, all of this, Protestant. But those Jews who wanted identification needed a stronger hold, a stronger background. It raised the problem of tradition. It raised the problem of tradition. If you said, as Geiger did, that between the Bible and the Enlightenment, the Jewish tradition had gone wrong, then it raised the problem of tradition, and it raised it in a very important way. How was that solved, that problem of tradition? It was solved in the same way that the Romantics solved their problem of tradition, for they had one too, their emotionality, this de-theologized Christianity. That's also a problem of tradition. If you de-theologize Christianity, where is your tradition? For Schleiermacher also thought that between Christ and Galilee and his own time, Christian history had gone wrong. You solve it by going to history. And so did the Jews. Part of this change of the Jewish community is a new sense of history, a new sense of history among Jews, which paralleled the new sense of history among the Romantics, which paralleled it. That same earth. It's tried to solve the problem of tradition. For in the Gentile world, you have now had the beginning, of course, of historical schools of thought. Hegel, you all know, Niebuhr's Roman history. And indeed, the new idea of the history of the Jews comes under Hegel's influence and from students who lived in Hegel's shadow. What I'm coming to now is the founding of something very important and very controversial, the science of Judaism. You will see why it is controversial and its origins, you will see why. But it is also, in a way, one of the solutions which goes with reform to the problem of tradition. The science of Judaism to which I now come, is still controversial. Last summer in Jerusalem, in a conference on the history of Jews, especially German Jews, the most controversial session which still raised real passion was the session of the science on Judaism. Because there are things involved which are both difficult from any religious point of view, and of course, very difficult, I should have thought, from a Zionist point of view. So you have both together. Because the science of Judaism is a part of what I have tried to explain to you. Let me summarize it this way before I go on to the science of Judaism. First of all, I have tried to explain to you why Jews accepted the conditions of emancipation. Secondly, that emancipation coincided with a change in the European opinion from the Enlightenment to Romanticism. This meant new accusations against the Jews and Judaism. Not new, the same ones of the Enlightenment, but now on a new Christian, if you like, a little deeper basis. Therefore, emancipation had to take account of that. And therefore, you get the development of emancipation in the direction of reform. A reform that tries to adjust Judaism to the dominant Protestantism of the North. We shall come to the South later. Similar adjustment was made. And dominant Protestantism of the North, which destroyed Mendelssohn's dollars in favor of the ethics of the fathers, the prophets, and which of course denied Jewish nationality in any territorial or folk sense. That is clear. And which instead deepened Mendelssohn's mission of Judaism. It deepened it because it put away the ceremonial law and let stand naked the ethical monotheism, which it connected to the state to which the Jew must be loyal, military service, active citizenship, the roads to emancipation, but the state within which the Jew as Jew had a special duty, namely to bring to bear upon the state the ethical monotheism of his religion, which would mean a liberal state, which would mean the kind of liberalism that I quoted to you early in this hour, a liberal state. Finally, I would like you all, if you can, to put yourself in the position of that generation. For much that I am saying now sounds to your ears very foreign. And it sounds foreign to your ears, partly because the Jews among you are assimilated and yet in the America totally unassimilated. So that's what you have in the peculiar American situation. This generation, however, still had lived in the ghetto. They wanted to get away from that. These were the solutions. These were the options. That you must never forget. The attraction of the high standards to them of European civilization is great. It will be great for all the people of the ghetto. For the Zionists or everyone want to come up to what to them, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly, but this is neither here nor there at the moment, was the standard of the promised land. The promised land to them from the ghetto and what they thought was a narrow religious culture. The promised land was philosophy, was history, was literature. The promised land was the West. The promised land was the culture. First the Enlightenment and then Romanticism. The forbidden reading in the ghetto was the promised land. This was the promised land. That you must never forget. This was the promised land. Physically and intellectually. And it is out of that that you must understand the modification of a tradition which seems barbaric and medieval. Therefore, Reform and its attitude swept the West. Therefore, Reform and its attitude will go on. Now, remember that on Friday, I would very much like to have a discussion with you here then at this hour. And will all of those, I'm sorry again, graduate students, honor students.